back, contrary to what you may have heard. In the aftermath of the general election, a commentator who will remain nameless wrote, "Two-party politics in Britain has proven to be more durable than fashionable opinion ever thought." And I think after the election, given that we had a Conservative majority government, there was an assumption that all of that talk about volatility and fragmentation had been wrong, and that Britain had quickly returned to the so-called classic, stable Westminster model that had guided its political system for much of the 20th century. But that obviously is not the case. 15 million votes at this election were cast for candidates who did not win, meaning that half of all those who voted at the 2015 general election supported somebody who did not end up being elected. Given turnout at the recent election, David Cameron has a majority, but that rests on the popular mandate of just 23% of the adult population, which is hardly a compelling mandate. And underneath the result of that general election, what we've seen below the surface is continuing declines in levels of party identification. The number of voters who strongly identify with the main parties has been falling, and the rise of the insurgents from the SNP to UKIP, to a lesser extent the Greens, has been visible to all. So we are still very much within a volatile, unpredictable and quite chaotic political environment, and that raises some really big questions about our electoral system and whether it is still in fact a viable or practical system for managing all of these new tensions and competing interests. And I'm somebody that shares the concerns of the Electoral Reform Society in believing that actually first past the post is not any longer a suitable system for our current political environment. But anyway, that's enough about me. The event tonight is co-hosted by the Fabians, the Electoral Reform Society, Compass and Progress, and we have a great panel of speakers, one of whom is going to arrive slightly late, but we won't punish him for that. Our first speaker is Olivia Bailey, Director of Research for the Fabian Society, who recently started in this post and was previously an advisor to Angela Eagle MP. The floor is yours for 7-8 minutes.
Thank you very much, and I shall attempt to keep to time as I know you're going to cut me off. as you just said, my background is that I was an advisor to Labour in the last Parliament, and as a result was kind of at the sharp end of some of Labour's attempts at cooperation with other political parties, in particular the Liberal Democrats, on things like party funding, on House of Lords reform, and saw how difficult it is to try and create that kind of cross-party cooperation. It was also my job to write jokes for Angela Eagle in Business Questions every Thursday morning, and unfortunately often the Liberal Democrats did end up as butt of those jokes. I can tell you a particularly bad one now. What do you think? Why did Nick Clegg cross the road twice? Because he specialises in double crossing. excuse me, sorry, I'll get back to topic. So we're discussing tonight campaigning and being heard in the new multi-party era. I want to raise two problems with a question and then sort of give a solution, or an attempt at a solution. And the first thing is to say, are we really in a multi-party era? As the Chair's just said, there has been massive de-alignment of people from political parties. So it was like about 90% in the 60s of people who said they were either Labour or Tory and strongly identified by being Labour or Tory. That's fallen to about 65% now. But if you look at the seats in Parliament, 562 seats are still held by Labour and the Tories. So under first past the post, we aren't really in a multi-party system. And, you know, Katie's excellent research that I'm sure she'll talk about later showed that, you know, at the last election, the Greens and UKIP got 5 million votes between them, but have only two seats in Parliament. So under first past the post, we don't really have a multi-party system. There's also the argument that while we've got, you know, the new parties, UKIP, the SNP, the Greens, there's nothing particularly new about the rise and fall of multi-party Britain. You know, in 1929, I think, was the last time we had a proper three-way contest for government. In 1983, the Liberal Democrat SDP alliance was only 700,000 votes behind the Labour Party, although again not reflected in the number of seats they received. So I think it's fair to say that over the century, parties have risen and fallen with the times, and perhaps the question's wrong to say it's a particularly new phenomenon, but I'll be interested to hear the panel's views. The second thing I wanted to say is, are we right to be focusing on political parties? And I would argue that no, we're not. It's kind of a feature of the Westminster bubble that we like to talk about top-down structures and political parties. But actually, members of political parties make up just 1.3% of the population, and the combined total of members of political parties is less than members of the RSPB. So when you think about it in that context, we're a tiny proportion of the public, and the majority of the public is switched off from politics. We've also seen, as I've discussed, huge de-alignment. So people perhaps used to say, I'm strongly Labour, perhaps it was strongly rooted in their class or their industry. That has fallen down over time. And people tend to now really go for issues rather than political parties, especially young people. And we should be talking about issues rather than about political parties, is my argument. So, for example, with UKIP, and perhaps Matthew, who I know is an expert on this, can come in on this particular point, but the issue of Europe and the issue of immigration, the Tories did well at winning back UKIP voters on Europe. We did badly at winning back UKIP voters on immigration. So on political issues is how we can win the argument, rather than focusing on collaboration between political parties. And I also say we have a massive problem with disillusionment in politics in our country. 33% of people didn't vote. That's only of registered voters. A huge number of people didn't register to vote. So instead of talking about political parties, surely we should be talking about how we should people to get engaged. Now, it's absolutely right that people are turned off by the kind of yaboo politics of politicians shouting each other across the chamber, but that is only one part of the problem. They're also turned off by, soundbite speak, a lack of representation in Parliament, politicians breaking their promises, and, I think a lot of that's what we've seen in the election of Jeremy Corbyn. So we shouldn't try and convince ourselves that pluralism is the solution to the problem of political disillusionment. It's only part of the solution. And then finally, my sort of forward-looking advice. Jeremy Corbyn concluded his speech today by saying he wanted to stir up divine discontent. I think that's got a lot in common with this debate that we're having today. And the problem is that it can't work. It's not possible to take the smaller parties, Greens, UKIP, the SNP, and use that to win a majority in Parliament under the first-past-the-post system. There's just not enough votes. We've done some analysis at the Fabians that shows that even if we had achieved a Scotland-style surge in turnout in the next election of 7%, and we won over every Green and Liberal Democrat voter, we still wouldn't have enough MPs to form a majority government. So my forward-looking lesson is the next election will be fought and won on the centre ground. We're going to have to win back votes off Tories as well as not losing votes from the left or right. We have to build a broad tent, which includes winning back significant numbers of Tory voters. So we can talk all we like about building coalitions on the left, working with other political parties, it's all important. And we also have to restore trust in politics. But to win the next election, we're going to have to win votes from Tories. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Olivia. I think many of my students would agree with the call of stirring up divine discontent. I think they're already doing it on a weekly basis in my seminars and lectures. Richard Angel is director of Progress, an organisation that has worked for over a number of years, many years in fact, in various roles. Richard has worked in various roles and has previously been involved with Labour students, and Progress was actually the first place that ever published some of my work, so thanks very much for that. Over to you.
Very proud. I'm going to stand up if that's okay. Yeah, so thank you very much for inviting me along today, and it's great to be on a panel with the ERS, who do a great job of trying to aspire for a better politics in this country, and it's good to be here with Compass and the Fabians as well to have this debate about how we go forward. So how do you campaign in a multi-party system? There is clearly a trend happening where a number of people who are voting is going down, the people who are loyal to particular parties is going down, but the rules remain the same. In elections, you have to get more votes than your opponents to take the prize of that local seat, and you need more seats than your opponent to take the prize of government, regardless of what calculation of the electorate that might require you to have on a given day, or whether we decide that is enough to give a moral mandate to the government of its time. That is a simple fact that you have to do. The thing, and why Olivia is right, and sometimes people from my wing of the Labour Party have sounded to fetishise this idea in some way about winning votes off people who voted Tory in the previous election, not necessarily people who are Tories. I'm not ever aiming to win over Tory party members or Tory party ideologues or fellow travellers, but there are lots of people out there who are uncommitted but happened to vote Tory last time. Sometimes every election end up voting Tory. That does not mean they are Tories, but I want to win them. But the reason why I want to win them so much, and the reason why in our current political system they matter so much, is when it's Labour versus Tory, they count as two. Because if you win a vote from somebody who voted Tory at the last election, you take one off their pile and one onto your pile. That really matters in elections. So every Lib Dem you get over to you, that counts as one for you. Every Green you get, everyone you knock off their pile and send to UKIP, you do the same. We lost people to UKIP as well. But when you win a vote directly from your main opponent, it counts as double. That is simple electoral fact, and it's why some of us are seen to fetishise over it. It's not because we want that politics to be that way, it's because our electoral system overly rewards politics in that way. The multi-era politics, one of the things it might do is make it easier to win as the mainstream parties, which is what has been happening and what the result shows. When the vote is split in lots of directions, but you have a pluralist system where you only have to have the most, not the majority, to win, sometimes this is making it easier for the main parties. And that's why David Cameron can be the Prime Minister on 24% of the popular vote. So that is a fact. It's cynical, but it is true. But how we campaign and win again under this politics comes in a number of forms. Firstly, I believe Labour will only win again when it has modernising politics at its forefront for doing it. I don't mean monopolising it, I don't mean necessarily in the leadership, but I mean it must be at the forefront of our offer to the British public, because you must go into elections not just with your supporters, but convincing other people and bringing them with them. But in the past, and in the very recent past of this leadership election, it has looked like we've only wanted to occupy a point on the political spectrum. What I want to see Labour being is not somewhere on the centre-left, but a left and centre party. It must be a broad coalition itself. And one of the things that we must do differently, not just as people who are in the previously known as Blairite wing of the party, if you will, we're all in a kind of recovery programme at the moment, but as a party generally, is build that coalition within our ranks. So we need to end the idea that we have some monopoly on good ideas. And I'm afraid it means we must end the idea that party members have a monopoly on good ideas. I love party members. I love being a party member. I love spending time with party members. Partly why I'm single and desperate, because I spend too much time, I think, with party members. But the idea that we are right all of the time just simply cannot be true. And it definitely isn't true since some point between 2005 and 2010, when we have lost two general elections, overwhelmed, I can't remember how many European elections we've lost in that time. We've lost in Scotland twice. Like, we are clearly don't have a monopoly on good ideas. And so one of the things we must do is be seen to be broader and more engaging and take other traditions, whether they're on the left or the centre, and build those people into our party and into our politics. And that is a really important thing that we do as we go forward. We must also change our paternalism as political parties. Many of them do it. We are particularly bad at this. When I started being an organiser, our strap line was on your side. We must be at people's side and doing people with them. The idea of doing politics for people now is redundant. I think people are frustrated. And out there, people feel powerless. They feel powerless economically. They feel powerless politically. They feel powerless in so many ways in their communities that our politics at all times must default to giving power back where we can, and then giving people the equipment, like it says on the back of our membership card, to have the strength of common endeavour and find ways that people can come together to be the answer to their own problems. We also have to have a view of the way we want politics to be done going forward. And I bend to nobody on being pro-AV+, that's a little niche, pro-House of Lords reform, pro-recall legislation, pro-party funding reform, pro-democratising the EU. I'm personally pro-compulsory voting, and I think it would be a really good thing. Having worked in Australia, I'm very pro-it. I know others have a different view. But for those of us who believe in a more pluralist political system, we have a big problem, and it is a Tory majority. And it is made worse by the last 5 years, because partly because of Matthew and his colleagues' writings, partly because of UKIP doing well in between elections, and partly because of a trend that is clearly happening that I won't rehearse because Olivia delivered it so wonderfully, is there was a sense that we might, all of us have to acknowledge that's changed, and that even meant in the Tory party. And there were people who were becoming electoral reformers in the Tory party, and a sense that neither side would win. My journalist friends would say to me, the funny thing about both of you lot is that none of you thought that you were going to win the next election. Well, clearly someone did. And what that has happened is meant the Tories, who were kind of flirting with the idea of electoral reform or thought this might be in their party's interest for the first time, are recoiling massively. It's very hard now to find any of those people admit that they were even flirting with it, let alone prepared to go further. And I think that means we've got a real problem. So the only way we get the new politics is by winning elections. But the only way that we are going to win elections, and I think if my starting premise is right, that modernising politics must be at least part of the four of doing that, the way we do our politics must change. And it was great today to see that as a key theme from Jeremy Corbyn's speech. It's clearly something he is personally passionate about. His personal style will lend itself to it. But I think we must caution a couple of things. While the Tories did get a majority with only 24% of the vote, we cannot be in a situation where, as the Labour Party, we think getting 11.3 million votes for the Tories makes them illegitimate, but 500,000 people voting in a leadership election means the world just changed. Because it really didn't. The Tories still have a majority of 12. They're still going to pass through the trade union legislation and take away the trade union ability to fund the Labour Party. They're still going to get away with the welfare reforms and all the terrible things that we hate about them. So we've got to go and build that majoritarian politics, not with other parties, but within our party. And we must be the way that people see their ambitions put forward. Ed Miliband was undoubtedly more pro-environment than Tony Blair. But I would hasten to guess that Blair got more votes from people who flirted with the Greens at some point than Ed Miliband ever did. And that is a problem. We must build that politics genuinely within our coalition and go forward to doing that. So I will end on that point and say that multi-party politics is exciting, but it doesn't mean the world has changed and the old rules of getting more votes than your opponents matters more than ever. Thank you.
Well, already lots of interesting things to think about and take into discussion. Really interesting, Richard. We'll move on now to Katie Ghose, who's Chief Executive from the Electoral Reform Society, a position that she's held since 2011. A lawyer by training, she previously worked on human rights issues and refugee issues as well. Katie, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I'll stand up too. Can you all hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Two fantastic contributions so far and much food for thought. And I just want to say it's fantastic to be here with Compass, Progress and the Fabians. We often try to come together at party conference to have these sort of discussions. So it's really great. Couldn't be more topical. Well, as Matt said in his introduction, some people have tried to suggest that the 2015 general election was the death knell for a multi-party era just because the result was a single party majority. I think that has to be absurd when the SNP, UKIP and the Greens got so many more votes than previously, and when the two biggest parties won their second lowest combined share in history. And I think Liv is absolutely right to say this isn't a new trend. You know, multi-party politics didn't suddenly happen on May the 7th. There's been a long-term trend away from the dominance of the two major parties in British politics. And just to share one stat, so there was a real jump this time round from 2010 in terms of the votes, the number of votes that went to parties other than the Conservatives, Labour and Lib Dems. So it went up to a quarter of the votes cast went to parties other than those three, and that was up from 12% in 2010, so it doubled. So I think there was a really significant shift, actually, when you look at people wandering off to other parties. And I think it was only first past the post that then distorted that result into a majority of 12 for the Conservatives. People have changed. They're not showing any signs of changing back. They want to see more parties competing for votes, and they want to choose between them. And Labour and other parties have to recognise that and respond. And I think one of the themes, I hope, for this evening will be kind of the creative ways for this party to get ahead of the game and to be responding, and what is it like to be in a multi-party era at a local level and at a national level. The argument we would make is that proportional representation is the only way to get fair democratic results and crucially logical results, not the kind of lottery results that you start to get when you have multiple parties competing in an old-fashioned two-party system. So we would argue that's the only way to get fair democratic results when there are so many parties now commanding so much of the vote. But I think wherever you are currently, and people have different views and feelings about electoral reform, there's something very important here about the party having an honest, open discussion about what it is like to be in a multi-party era. What does that feel like when you're on the doorstep and your campaign is going to be different in different bits of the country? We had the Cambridgeshire City Council leader talking about how passionate he actually is about working with neighbouring councils run by Conservatives. Other people will have different experiences and different views, but I think it's really important to have that conversation. Going beyond the kind of basic principle of electoral reform, I think there are other reasons why Labour in particular might benefit from committing to proportional representation. I would argue that it would actually allow the party to define itself properly. And Richard, you've talked about the broad church, and parties are broad churches or broad creatures. That's really challenging now, isn't it? I mean, you must experience that. The logic of the kind of marginal seats means that traditional parties are having to narrow their offer and basically talk to a couple of 100,000 people. And that can really exclude other voters and supporters that you're trying to appeal to. It really narrows the offer. And yet at the same time, the logic of seeking to be a majority winning party under first past the post means you kind of got to stretch your support base almost to breaking point, appealing to absolutely everybody on the far left and everybody on the right and everybody in between. Is that really possible for a party to do anymore? I'm not sure it is. And then, of course, in the safe seat culture, I don't know how many of you here are in safe seats, so many voters, so many citizens feel completely ignored in safe seats. And then you've got people in the marginals and the competitive seats feeling kind of awash with love and attention from politicians. Mm-hmm. Do we really want a democracy like that, where it's a complete postcode lottery as to how much time you have with elected representatives and how much attention you have from them at election time? I just don't think that's sustainable. So I think there's something here, if we were to change system and political culture, of Labour not having to kind of bang the marginal seat drum at election time, actually defining themselves and their identity, planting 2 feet on the political map, saying this is what we stand for, and commanding real election winning support. And I think in these, you know, fascinating times for Labour, proportional representation could give the party that real opportunity to define itself and then to work with others in the way it really wants to do. I think the final kind of thought I'd give in terms of why Labour might particularly be interested in exploring new ways of doing politics is something about putting in perspective what happened this year, because I think it's been kind of presented almost in a catastrophic way, and there's been something here about that the actual support that is out there for Labour on the ground is not translated and reflected under our current electoral system. You know, you would think under a PR system in Scotland there'd be about 15 MPs there. What does that mean in terms of having a base to grow from? You know, how hard is it for a party when you've got no councillors there, but you've got a load of people who are voting and supporting for you? And I think that's one of the terrible features now about having an old-fashioned two-party system trying to kind of operate in a multi-party age is it actually denies the support that is out there. It doesn't translate that support and those votes and those people into actual real councillors. And we all know that councillors are working their socks off, trying to help everybody in the community around them. I think there's a real denial at the heart of the system. So that's one of the reasons why I feel so strongly now about the move. I think there's been some kind of real catastrophising of the result. Actually, Labour got 1.5% more votes than in 2010, but 26 fewer seats. So again, we're just seeing this real distortion in terms of actual support and then what it kind of ends up being translated to in terms of parliamentary. In England, there was a swing to Labour, but seats were lost. Are we really going to kind of carry on that in that fashion with this kind of failure now to kind of effectively translate support into representation? And it was a 7% finish behind the Conservatives, hardly the complete wipeout that First Past the Post presents it to be. So I think all of these things are really worth considering. And of course, people have been reflecting on Scotland, where Labour got a quarter of the vote but just one seat. The SNP gets twice as many votes and 56 as many seats. And I think that's one of the things that's really changing the debate now is that experience in Scotland. So to end, of course, in particular to party conferences are all about galvanising and winning and coming up with the strategies and the tactics. They are absolutely all about that, as Richard has correctly identified. But First Past the Post makes that challenge seem almost insurmountable, whereas Labour's actual support in the country is not disastrous as it's being presented to be. Multi-party politics is here to say the Conservatives won a majority, but it was a 12-seat majority and it's being treated as a landslide. Perhaps the Conservatives or Labour or another party can play the First Past the Post game with enough panache and skill to win a majority again. But the direction of travel is clear. People don't vote tribally. They don't vote the way they used to. And that is increasingly making majorities a thing of the past. Labour can get ahead of that trend by working out how to cope with multi-party politics, by embracing proportional representation and helping us update politics for the 21st century. All parties are facing this challenge of modernising, becoming 21st century creatures, not the 19th or the 20th century institutions they started out as. We've all got a choice, haven't we, in life? We can look at the world as it was, or we can look at the world as it is. And I think we should be looking at the world as it is. Thank you.
Another set of very interesting comments. It always is quite striking to me before the elections when the Electoral Reform Society predicts how many seats they can successfully predict the outcomes in, which I believe was over 300 this time.
Well over
300. And just what the effect of those safe seats is actually having on voters who aren't supporting those candidates. Let's move swiftly onwards to our last speaker, then we can get in lots of questions, lots of discussion, which I know is going to be great. Neil Lawson is a well-known figure and thinker on the left of British politics, who is the chair of Compass, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much,
Neil, for 7 or 8 minutes.
Thank you, and it's great to be here and showing pluralism in action between the Fabians, Electoral Reform Society, Progress and Compass. I'm sorry I was a little bit late. I've got a good reason. I was at a strategy meeting talking about PR with a mixture of Greens, Liberal Democrats, Labour people, non-aligned, trying to think through what the strategy is, which can unlock our failing, awful democratic system. So I've got a good excuse. I'm really sorry I didn't hear everything, because I find I don't learn anything listening to my own voice. And so I look forward to hearing all we're going to talk about for the rest of the meeting. This is my third conference this week. I was in Bournemouth on Tuesday at the Liberal Democrats talking about PR to packed meetings, really energised, really keen on what's happening with Corbyn, really looking to branch out. They quite like the fact that the leader of the Labour Party looks more like a Liberal Democrat than any Liberal Democrat. I went back to Bournemouth on Sunday to talk at the Green Conference, actually to their conference. They asked me to go and speak to their conference about PR and where it was going. So, 500 people or something. Again, real kind of openness appetite to kind of engage with Corbyn Labour and look to try and change the politics. And I pick up this week, really, a sentiment about PR, which I've not really picked up at Labour conferences before. You know, a few weeks ago, the TUC cracked open the debate about PR at their Congress. Really interesting. I mean, for that to happen, that's a really big breakthrough in British politics for the brothers and sisters to contemplate moving away from first past the post. John McDonald, as we know, has switched from being first past the post to PR. Corbyn himself has said that his issue is the constituency link, and I think we can solve the constituency link for him under a more proportional system. John Trickett said he no longer feels able to back the first past the post system. He's the person responsible for the constitutional convention, citizens' assemblies, whatever it's going to be. So there's another space that's opening up. And one of the ones I like most, really, is the continued support of the SNP for PR, a party who's had no interest whatsoever electorally of moving, you know, away from first past the post, has got the gumption and the moral spirit to continue to campaign for it. So we've got, you know, three parties, Labour moving onto that agenda, the trade unions moving onto that agenda, important people. And I think what we've got to do is know the right kind of arguments about why we want to move, why we want to crack this open, and how do we prosecute the case. And, you know, the fairness argument is a good one. It's the right one. We should make it. But it's not the thing that's going to really move this on. There are three quick points I want to make about how we really develop the PR message within and around the party. The first is the sense that it's a system of voting, a system of politics that's on the right side of history. Right, modernity means that our political system, like our economic and social systems, are going to get more and more complex. In a network information society, you need a complex system of doing politics. There's no way around that. First past the post is the system for the 19th and 20th century. Two classes, two binary divides, linear politics, simple, straightforward, black and white, one side or the other. That world is gone, right? That's why the whole multi-party system is cracking open, and we won't go back to it. And I think there are real challenges for Labour in that. Labour is a party of, and social democracy is a party of the 19th and 20th century, of the factory, not Facebook, of doing things to people and not with people. And I think there's a real kind of cultural issue that Labour's going to have to break through if it's going to be part of that modern agenda. But we can own that agenda as far as PR is concerned. The second point is, just very simply, it's the right thing to do. Strip everything away, everything we believe in, everything we say, every policy, every strategic difference that me and Richard have about how the Labour Party should operate. What we share together is a belief in people's ability to run and manage their lives collectively. We believe in human beings and how they, as I say, how they can act and behave together. And that's what PR is about. It's about, more than anything, it's just saying that we trust the people. That there are no fixes, there are no shortcuts, that you're going to have to give the decisions to the people, and PR does that. And we've got to open ourselves up to that because, you know, as a socialist, that's what I believe more than anything. That people have the ability, the capability to manage their world effectively, and we should give them an electoral system, or they should take and demand an electoral system that gives that. And again, Labour's got real problems because it can't help putting, confusing means and ends and thinking that the means justify the ends. And they never, ever do, right? The good society will not be, you know, we won't arrive at a good society through the wrong kind of methods. And we can't create a good society based on a discredited, fixed, foul electoral system that cheats people out of their votes and tells them that we don't trust them. So that's my second point. And my final point is that if we want to change our politics, the first thing that we can do, and in fact the only thing we can do, is change ourselves. We have to start acting and behaving. That's why this event is so good and so important, like the new politics. We have to start trusting people. We have to start working with people. We have to start opening ourselves up. In Compass, we talk about the notion of an open tribe. We recognise that as members of the Labour Party, that's what gets us out of bed and that's what we're going to vote for. But we can be open to other people and we can work with other people. How ridiculous in Brighton that the Greens stood a candidate against Nancy Platts and let a Tory in. How absolutely ridiculous, and how equally stupid that Labour tried to pin Caroline Lucas down and defeat her. These are people that share the same values, and somehow, if we want to change our politics, we're going to have to find a way of working through all of that, just as we're going to have to find a way through ensuring that Liberal Democrats win a whole swathe of seats in the South West that we can never win. So we've got to start behaving and thinking in an open, plural and complex way. And the challenge for us is to be the change we wish to see in the world. in that sense. And I look, I've never been more hopeful for the politics and prospects of PR. I think we've got to work really hard at it. But history's on our side, morality's on our side. If we can behave and act in the right kind of way, then it will happen sooner than we think.
Okay, well, let's open the floor up for questions. I'll take three at a time. If you keep them short and sweet, we've got more room for other people to ask questions. Yes, sir. Chat there and the guy at the back. Yep. Short and sweet.
Thank you. John Young, most exciting news I've heard at this conference was at a fringe meeting at lunchtime when we were told, but Jeremy Corbyn supports proportional representation. Now, I can't remember any previous leader in office promoting that. I think it's a really important move that he should make, particularly that is because he wants a new star. This is surely the way to go, and you know, we must really encourage him in this.
That's great. The second, the chap with the check shirt.
Thank you. Vinod Kumar from Barnet. Finsley Labour Party. My question is, the case for electoral reform is very strong. The issue is, with the Tories having gained a majority, however slender a popular vote, why would they buy into it? And in the absence of that, how can we move forward? After all, in the last time, because they needed a coalition, therefore they conceded a referendum. At that time, of course, Labour didn't really wholeheartedly buy into it, and therefore the referendum was badly lost. So, what do we learn from that, and how can we actually achieve success?
And the very tall hand at the back.
Neil Harding, Brighton Resiliency, I believe. I can't remember the lady's name, sorry.
Olivia.
Olivia and Richard. They're sort of arguing that we've got to go for the Tory vote, seems to be. Thing. I mean, the way I looked at that was there's 24% of the electorate voted for the Tories and 76% who either voted for us or didn't. So you've got about 56% of the electorate who are either non-voters or didn't vote for Labour or the Tories. So we'd need about 5% of that 56% to have more votes than the Tories, or we go to 2.5% of the Tory vote, the Tory 24%. So I don't actually think it's any harder to go for 5% of 56 than to go for 2.5% of 24, if you get the point. I know it's twice as many votes, but there's twice as many votes out there, potentially. So I don't actually think it's any harder. But anyway, I think we've probably got to do a bit of both, actually. But I think the votes are out there. And what Neil said is absolutely right on... basically, I think parties are going to have to work together and make some sort of electoral pact might be the way. But there we go.
Well, why don't we take Richard and Olivia on that last point, Katie, and then Neil, if he wants to come in on how do we convince the Conservatives that it's in their interests as well to push reform.
Look, I thought I was really clear. I don't want to win over Tories. Like, if you are a committed member of the Tory party, if you are a fellow traveller, if that's where your political ideas are, the chance of doing it is going to be very, very limited. My point was this, that there are people who vote and last time voted Tory. A million people were undecided in the last week, but they conclusively went Tory, right? That doesn't mean they are Tories. That means they were open. They even wanted to vote for us. They were just looking for a reason, and for a variety of reasons, they were scared off of doing it. It must be possible to win some of those people over, as they were saying. Someone was telling us they were going to vote Labour until that very last minute. Part of the reason why we make that argument is that those people do vote. So it is much easier... somebody who is going to go to the polling station to convince them which way they vote than to have to do sometimes the 3-4 part process of inspiring enough to be interested to answer the door to then get them to want to vote for, to vote at all and then to vote for you. But like I said, I'm in favour of compulsory voting because I want everybody to vote. I am an absolute idealist about this. I hate walking past houses when I go canvassing and all that kind of stuff. But the other point I just caution on this idea that there is a kind of silver bullet of, I don't know, you say we have to do both, and obviously we do, but the idea that there's a silver bullet of the non-voters out there. In the 100 seats with the lowest levels of turnout, Labour holds 91 of them. This is ultimately a strategy for bigger majorities in seats we currently hold. And the only thing I agreed with lots of, Neil won't know this, but you will, because you heard, we agreed with lots of things. We actually said lots of the same thing about how we want to do politics. The only bit that I'm pessimistic about, where Neil seems very optimistic about, is I think, one, that bounce back factor from Tories who flirted with the idea of that it might be in their interest for the first time to be in favour of PR, now are kind of zealots the other way. They're like reformed smokers. The fact they even engaged with the idea and then found a way of getting a majority means they totally recoiled from it. But the other thing is, Katie said multi-party politics is safe. It is. So is first past the post while there is a Tory majority. And we have to get rid of that Tory majority before we can get rid of the voting system. They are never going to gift us a better politics because it will never, ever be in their interest.
I agree with a lot of what Richard's just said. I don't mean to say that we shouldn't try and win over the coalition of people on the left, Liberal Democrat and Green voters. Of course we should. But I've actually looked at this issue in quite a lot of detail. When we did some research just after the election called The Mountain to Climb, which showed that we had to win over significant numbers of Tory voters, and Jeremy Corbyn argued in a Labourist interview that perhaps we hadn't looked at the issue from both ends of the telescope. So I went away, I looked at the numbers again, and I tried to look at the three parts of his strategy to see whether or not we would have been able to win a majority in the marginal seats we'll need to win in order to do that. The first part was winning over non-voters, was one of the things that Jeremy said he wants to do. At the last election, we had 5 million conversations. We ran a fantastic ground operation out of Brewers Green that was, you know, everyone said was very good, loads of conversations, great campaign teams. We increased turnout by 1% across the country, and just over 1% in the marginal seats that we focused on hugely. And even if we secured that sort of Scotland-style surge in turnout that I talked about earlier, which is perhaps a comparable example of 7%, we still would only gain, I think, 11 seats in the marginal seats that we'd need to win. The second thing that Jeremy said he wants to do is kind of squeezing the kind of anti-Tory votes, the coalition of the sort of Green and Lib Dem voters, the coalition of the disenchanted that I talked about earlier on. And even if you added together all of those votes in the marginal seats that we needed to win, and we won every single one of them, we still wouldn't have enough seats. In fact, if you add together all of the non-voters, the 7% Scotland-style surge, all of the voters who voted Liberal, Democrat and Green in the seats that we need to win, the marginal seats that we need to win to form a majority, we can't form a majority. So I don't say that with any glee. I just say it as a statement of fact based on the numbers that I've looked at. Of course we need to do both. But I think with first past the post, with the system that we have to fight and win the election on the centre ground. And of course there's another point as well, just very quickly, Chair, which is that there's a danger that we lose votes from the centre. So the more you kind of appeal to the Liberal Democrat and Green votes, perhaps, on the left, you lose votes at the centre. And we actually did lose votes to the Conservatives at the last election, which is perhaps something we don't discuss enough.
In some seats we did, but then some other seats we didn't. Like, we gained 1 million votes in England, and the Tories only gained half a million.
In certain areas of England, you gain 1 million votes. I mean, one of the big problems for the Labour Party electorally, Southern England in particular, and trying to get into some of those key marginals again. And Katie, how could the Conservative Party be persuaded of the case for reform?
Well, the ERS works with all parties, people from all parties and none, and like Neil, I've been on a kind of roadshow around all the party conferences, and we'll be going to the Conservative Party conference to have these very discussions. I think things are a bit more nuanced, actually, depending on whether you're talking about local electoral reform, and we're campaigning for the Scottish system that's used for local elections down in Scotland to be adopted in England and Wales, which we think would be a great deal fairer, as well as campaigning vigorously for reform at Westminster. And actually, in the last Parliament, we found that an increasing number of Conservatives did become interested, particularly in the kind of local reform. So what is the practical path to achieve change? Well, one of the first things we've got to do is exactly what we're doing now. We're having an open discussion based on the kind of principles. What's the kind of political culture? What's the kind of democracy that we want to have? Stephen the MP Stephen Kinnock has a kind of economic perspective on this. So he actually thinks it's really wrong that in a lot of investment will just go to marginal seats. He sees a direct link between money and investment in areas that desperately need it and a kind of an electoral system. That's a whole other set of arguments. One of the first things to do, I think, is to have that kind of open exploration very much from principles rather than leading to systems. The second point, one of your questions was, what do we learn from the AV referendum? One of the biggest lessons is not to kind of jump to a solution before people have actually decided for themselves that there's a problem there. So one of the reasons why we talk so much and spend so much time diminishing and delegitimising and talking about what is wrong with first past the post is that's the first thing we have to do before we leap to some sort of argument about solutions or whatever. So I think a very practical terms, the Constitutional Convention that John Trickett's going to be taking forward could be a fantastic opportunity for citizens, for people to get to grips with electoral reform and to talk about it. The brutal truth is that one of the two major parties, Conservative or Labour, has to decide and commit to proportional representation for the change to happen, and that's why it's so important that we're here today and having that conversation.
Forgive me, what role for the new party leader?
Neil, I'm sure you want to come in here. You're at the Green Conference and the Liberal Democrat Conference. I was in Doncaster at the UKIP Conference where they felt very angry about the system. And I wonder, to what extent can Labour work with all of the parties across the spectrum to kind of deliver on this? How likely is that?
Well, I hope Jeremy has backed PR. That's a big step forward. I haven't heard that news, but I hope he has, and of course he can play a leading role. But if it's an issue of democracy, this can't be any single party's ownership, and we have to work with everyone that wants a better democratic system and be seen to work with everyone, including UKIP, if that's what they want. Just to sort of momentarily, and it'll only be momentarily, end the love-in with Richard, I'm not a fan of compulsory voting. You spend too much time in Australia... which is one of the most arid, polarised, horrible systems, and it breaks that bargain because it says we don't trust people, and it gets us off the hook of making a political system that people want to go and vote for. So I don't believe in leading people to the opinion polls and making them vote. I think it's up to us to help design a system that is worth voting for, and I don't want to duck that challenge. And I think in Australia it underpins a very bad form of politics. But what do we do? Because turkeys won't vote for Christmas. If they did, I don't know what system that they would use to decide on it, whether it be first past the post or proportional or what. And that's where, look, this is where the whole debate is now cracking open. What do we do about that? How do we get the Tories out in order to change the electoral system? And you can put all your eggs in the basket. There's too many turkeys and eggs going on here. But you can put all your eggs in the Labour majority basket if you want to, and cross your fingers and hope that's going to happen. I'm not sure that is going to happen, not least because multi-party politics is here, and not least because the thing we've avoided the whole summer is the kind of, the global-wide crisis of social democracy. There is no social democrat party anywhere in the world that is on the front foot intellectually, electorally, and organisationally. There isn't. There is a crisis because it's got the baggage and the culture and the history of the last centuries and not this, and it's struggling everywhere. And if you want to bet, the ranch on it securing a majority and bringing in PR, it's not. I really doubt it's going to happen. So we have to start thinking about a whole load of things, and I don't know what the answer is, but let's have that conversation. Should we have electoral pacts? Should we decide, should localities, not from the top down, from localities, decide not to stand in certain places in order to break it open? Should that just be on constitutional issues, or should it be on wider issues? Would people just be motivated by constitutional issues, but should it be broader? We should think about that. And I'll let you into a little secret. Myself and someone from the Liberal Democrats in 1997 brokered a meeting between the now Lord Mandelson and the now Lord Renard. And there was an electoral pact in 1997. There was a huge electoral pact in 1997. No one knew about it. It was all about the two parties ensuring that they didn't campaign in each other's target seats. So no resources, no big visits, nothing happened. And what happened? There was a huge Labour landslide. And the Liberal Democrats went up increasingly. And there's precedent in history in 1906, and all sorts of times when Liberals have stood down in favour of Labour and pushed the Labour right. This is part of our history and part of our politics, and we should be thinking about this, because if we're serious about it, and there are real problems, you know, clearly the electorate want a choice, and there are real problems with all of this. If we want to change our politics, we want to change our system, we're going to have to start having those really difficult conversations about the options now.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what role for Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, he's the leader of the Labour Party, you know. But look, none of these things are going to happen because a leader says they want it to happen. It's going to happen because a party and many parties and moods in the country and movements start making it happen. It's great if Jeremy's on board. Yeah. That's brilliant. That helps. But it's a much bigger thing than just that.
I'd like to get two more answer questions. You've had a great opportunity to ask a question. Here at the front, right at the back, on the back right with the hand up, and the gentleman over on the left over here.
Hello. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on local government, and we seem to be mostly talking about first past the post in the parliamentary elections. A couple of reasons why I'm interested. So I'm a councillor from Stroud District Council. 4 years ago, we took control from the Tories, but we've run the council actually very successfully in combination with the Greens and the Liberal Democrats. And to start with, the Central Labour Party was very reluctant to give us permission to go into this. It's not a formal coalition, it's an alliance, but it's actually worked very well. I don't know if you can think of any other examples where that's happened. And we've got local elections, we've got all-out elections coming up next year, and one of the problems we're finding is, so Stroud is actually just a very diverse district, so we've got Tory areas, Green, and everything Green's quite strong as well. We're finding it quite hard to find Labour candidates, so I don't know if there's an appetite, for example, in my ward, there's just me at the moment, and I've got two vacancies, to have an alliance between maybe Green and Liberal Democrats. I don't know if there's an appetite in the Labour Party to look at that sort of thing on a local level going forward. So
okay, can we keep it? So, yeah. Sorry. And the lady at the back against the wall?
Don't shoot her.
Sorry. I'm Annie Leicester South, constituency party. It's really a question about PR. I'd like to understand a bit more about the potential for a kind of constituency MP model within a PR. So it's a kind of educational question, really. Tell me more about how PR might look and still have a constituency link.
Okay, and the gentleman against the wall over there.
Please don't shoot me either. Hi, Peter Campbell, Packlin, CLP. I've volunteered an open policy exercise for the past year. I was wondering what the panel thought about open policy, digital campaigning, those techniques as a way of, are there a way of bringing more people into the movement and actually delivering change whilst opposition? And particularly, could we try it in local authorities? And it's a way of actually building that kind of thinking up at the local area so we can then deliver it in a general election.
Okay, so two questions focused on the local level, a sort of educational type question at the back about the role of constituency MPs within a PR type arrangement. Should we start, Richard, with you and work our way along? I want to get at least another round of questions in, so let's try and keep it relatively brief.
I'm going to start with the constituency role, because I think that is important. I think I'm a massive pro-European, but I think our MEP system, the way they're elected, how they're accountable to millions of people, is a total failure. It's barely democratic. Just because there happens to be a vote in a box at some point, there seems almost no link to who you vote for and what happens in an institution you never possibly hear from. So I want as localised form of PR possible, which I am in favour of AV Plus, which, like I said, is quite a niche thing of, you still have constituents left, and over a very small area, like the old English counties, you have a top-up to do it, which gets rid of some of the issues about swathes of the country where there is no-go areas for Labour while actually there being a Labour vote, but does mean you have that direct link, because the reason why lots of people vote in X Factor is because they can go on and vote and they can see the outcome within an hour and a half of that outcome. Our politics seems so remote from people that they go out and vote in a general election and the outcomes they see just seem totally unconnected from that, and the biggest fear from PR ultimately, I think, is that. And the problem for us almost with that is the more you keep a constituency link, and therefore the smaller the form of PR, so either STV with three members rather than, I think Ireland has six, or you have this kind of AV Plus system, is that some of the benefits of PR are reduced, so it's harder to kind of idealistically argue for it, but I think that is best for our politics. But the question about local coalitions and how we build them, I want to talk about Bristol. We've got a big challenge, and Jeremy's made this key part of his leadership, which is great, of getting getting Marvin Rees to be the mayor of Bristol, and I think this is really important. But what was very sad to see, and you saw Labour, I think, at its worst in this, where he absolutely engenders this new politics. He's a multiracial guy who doesn't like the idea of being siloed in a particular way. He is progressive and left in every meaning of the world, but he doesn't quite, in some ways, fit into the Labour Party well. He's something naturally that Greens and Lib Dems should want to vote for if we can present him as genuinely him. We put an identikit campaign on him, turned into a robotic Labour candidate, partly because Bristol Labour Group said they wouldn't work, and because he wanted to have a cabinet that had people from the Greens and Lib Dems in it. And the Labour group basically just pummeled him into him saying no, he wouldn't have other parties. Those councillors, however, when we lost that mayoralty to an independent, which is basically a Lib Dem who resigned his party because they were quite unpopular at the time, all served, and they all took the King's shilling. And I thought it was absolutely outrageous that we had somebody who engendered the kind of politics that actually probably Neil represents maybe more than myself. But I think this is a young, inspiring guy who has real visions for his town and his city, but our old-fashioned institutions, our tribalism, held back our ability to have a coalition in the city, which meant that we didn't win, but we took the prize anyway through the back door, and now we're partly running Bristol, but the mayor gets all the credit and we get all the crap. And I think that's pretty outrageous, and it's because the Labour Party took a very short-term narrow interest when it should look much broader where possible and see what's best for a city.
Katie, do you want to speak to the question at the back about how this would actually work?
Yes, so yes, you can have a constituency link and proportional voting. You have slightly larger constituencies that you'd have now, and maybe sort of 3, 4, 5 MPs. You'd have sort of a team of MPs. You'd hope they'd collaborate on some of the kind of practical stuff, but also have very distinct policy differences and so on between them, and be from different parties. The system is in use. It's actually used for local elections, picking up on your point, in Scotland. It's called the single transferable vote. And instead of XXX voting, multi-member wards, you vote 1, 2, 3. So, you know, one for your top candidate and so on. Could say a lot more about it, but I think the key point is, yes, you could have a constituency. It's a different sort of relationship. I think there's a lot of myth-making around actually how strongly the public feel about having one MP. I think a lot of MPs feel very strongly about the constituency link. But the simple answer is, yes, you can have a constituency relationship and you can have proportional voting in one.
And there is a lot of information on the Electoral Reform Society website. I can testify to that. Olivia, would you like to respond to a couple of the questions?
Absolutely, thank you very much. Look, I think there's a danger that we end up talking to ourselves on this issue. The case for PR has not been made across the party. It's great that Jeremy has said that today, but if you look at the AV referendum, the party is split down the middle on it. And I think that we need to think really carefully, if we are all in favour of a change to the voting system, about how we can make the case. And I personally think that the question about local government is right on the money, because I think local government, PR and local government, is the way we can do that. Yeah. Labour has to win seats in Middle England that it has never previously won before, where currently it has no representation on councils. How do you build a base in seats like that? You have councillors and you have active CLPs. So there's a really strong electoral and pragmatic case that we can be making as well for PR and local government. So I think that's one thing I'd add in. And the second thing on the question on open policy and digital techniques, and it's a really important question. I think a legacy from Margaret Thatcher is the kind of buy and sell model of politics, and people want everything immediately. So they kind of say, I voted for this, why haven't I got it now? The broken politics that we've seen, the broken promises we saw in the last parliament is another example of how that really damages trust in politics and politicians. In Jeremy Corbyn's election, the huge surge of supporters that we saw coming in were people who were able to very quickly sign up, feel a part of something and see results really, really quickly. It's really good he's talking about how we can reform the policy-making processes in the party, and I think we need to be thinking in terms of like one click, quick engagement, so people can feed into our policy processes, give us ideas. We tried that in the last parliament with the NPF process, but we need to go further. But instead of just having the one click and then bye-bye, we need to take people on a journey. So from that first interaction right through then to being in the CLP, and we have to break down the kind of barriers of the kind of opaque CLP structure where you kind of go to a meeting and you're met with a top table and people talking about AGMs and procedural motions. So it's all really important. I could talk all day about it.
Well, don't come to an academic departmental meeting, that's all I'm going to say. Neil, would you like to chip in here? You feel free to reflect on
only quickly, I guess, more questions. I mean, I think the new technology is helping. If you look at the way Podemos in Spain are making policy in their circles, using apps like Lumio for 200 people to debate things and decide things, it builds in real kind of buy-in and engagement and experience and different voices, and the party's got to open itself up to all of that. As far as local government's concerned, well, all the same stuff applies nationally, but even more so to local government, and the kind of, you know, the fiefdoms of, you know, 100% majority rule, which just breeds in kind of laziness and complacency and, you know, lack of choice. It's just, you know, and as a lot of these authorities are getting more power, you know, it's making the problem worse. We've really got to crack that open. I think the experience of Labour in Scotland in local government, even before the SNP wipeout, was that actually, you know, PR was not a bad thing, because it was building more efficiency and more trust and more relationships and all of that. So we bring it in, and just to say that if we don't, there'll be a backlash, and it's already starting. I was in Frome a couple of weeks ago, a small town in Somerset. 400 people came from all across the country to discuss this thing called flat pack democracy, because they're fed up of local fiefdoms, whether that's Tory, Liberal Democrat or Labour, and they're sweeping them away as independents, but quite progressive independents, quite democratic independents. And there's a movement afoot to kind of not put up with this anymore. So we haven't got a choice about this, really. People are not going to accept, you know, dull, complacent, you know, 100%, you know, piss-taking authorities. They're not, quite rightly. And they're going to find a way of organising around it, and who can blame them?
We've got time for another round of questions. Check the middle. We've got a big hand going up over there. We've got three here. Do we have any others just singing? Okay, I'm sort of doing all males panels questions all the time. Well, the three sat together. We'll probably have time for you in a sec.
Okay. David Lister, I'm from Brent Central. I'm a strong supporter of PR, but I also take the point that in terms of 2020, we've got to be thinking about how we're going to get Labour votes. I wanted to go back really to the point that the comrade from Brighton raised. It seems to me that there are large numbers of people who didn't vote, and we're sort of saying, well, you know, that this is marginal. But it seems to me that there's three categories of people who could be significant. I mean, one is youth. You know, there's a lot of young people who don't vote. And, you know, we've got the possibility that Jeremy Corbyn and his whole effect across the party could really make a difference in greatly increasing the number of young people who vote. The second category is people who say there's no difference between parties. I mean, we did extremely well in Grant, but I still, in campaigning, came across a lot of people like that, and I don't think they're going to be able to say that in the next election. So they're another possible area. And the third thing I'd ask people to think about is the point that Jeremy Corbyn raised today about getting people on the register. You know, he was asking for a fantastic turnout, wasn't he, by members to do that. And I think you're not only looking there, people who've slipped off the register, there's also the huge number of people who aren't on it. And I think that obviously those three things in themselves are not going to change things. And I agree with the point about winning points for people from the Tories. But I think that could make a significant difference in getting non-voters to vote next time.
Okay.
James Butler, over in St Pancras. Neil's talked about trust, and I think that's right, and but when you do that, it leads to painful places. If you trust the British people, generally speaking, and it's hard to be objective, but in general elections and the first past the post, they generally get it right. And the Labour Party, we all need to face up to that. I can take issue with Olivia's point about how wonderful the campaign was. It was awful. Everything about it was wrong.
I worked for the party at the time, so you have to...
Okay, that's true. Well, I don't need to go into the details of what was wrong. Everything was wrong. And surely the lesson that we've got to learn is to be better, and that's how you win. Third point, and final point, Chair. People talked about local PACs and whatever, and I have to go off my chest, my experience of a political assistant in Hackney when we had a Labour Conservative administration for about 18 months. I don't know where that leads the discussion, but I just need to get off my chest.
We had a third question, and then we'll come back.
Thank you. I'm Gregory Kent of Lewis CLP, just up the road. I have to mention the elephant in the room. 2011, 67% of people voted against a minimal PR or proposition. And you can't put that just down to poking the clegg in the eye. as a lifelong supporter of electoral reform, voted against because I didn't like coalition politics, and that's what you're going to be left with PR. I actually suddenly realised this wasn't what I wanted. I did not want a Liberal Democrat party that's always, I've always thought was stood for a certain kind of politics, to get in bed with the Tories and allow them into power. It was a coup that happened in 2010, helped by that kind of politics. And 67% of people voted against it, but actually the really important statistic is only 41% of people even bothered to voice their views on PR. So I think you're all sort of living in an Alice in Wonderland world here, where you're not really engaging with the reality of what the way British people live and their views on PR.
Well, that is a great question to put back to the panel. Are we living in the Alice in Wonderland? Should we start this side and come down? Some great questions, great questions.
The AV referendum, look, it wasn't PR. It was the wrong system proposed by the wrong people at the wrong time, right? It was a shit campaign. You know, it never should have been done in that way. And everyone said that the electoral reform debate is now dead for a generation, and it's not. It's not, because we've got a rotten electoral system that needs changing, and, you know, for all the arguments you've heard across the panel. And, you know, you may not like coalitions, but, you know, it just shows how bad first past the post is, that even first past the post is, you know, will increasingly deliver coalition politics because of the multi-party thing going on, and the fact that, you know, none of the two parties or the two old main parties are delivering politically for people. This is going to keep breaking up. What was supposed to happen? Was no government supposed to be formed after 2010? Was everyone just supposed to stand around and look
minority,
at their feet?
Minority Tory government.
Well, that's up to politicians to negotiate that and do that. Would you have liked a Labour Lib Democrat coalition? Do you want no coalition? Do you want chaos? Do you want vote by vote? You know, the fact is that Labour didn't engage with the Liberal Democrats at all. It ran away. It left the country to the Conservatives. And we should never have done that. Even in however difficult the circumstances are, you always try and defend the people who need defending. And we ran away because we couldn't do a deal with anyone, because we're tribal, because we're singular, because we don't want any truck with Liberal Democrats. And would I rather have a government now, a Conservative government that's pulled back by the Liberal Democrats? Yes, I would. I absolutely would, because it will protect more people, and I think we're going to miss them a bit, and we might look back a bit more fondly on the Liberal Democrats. They made a hell of a lot of wrong decisions, but any shield, any dented shield, is better than George Osborne on his own ruling over the people. And I think we've got to kind of begin to grow up and be a bit more cruel and a bit more, and that might be Alice in Wonderland to you, but that's real hard politics about the people that we need to defend and work for and work with. It's been great questions. Look, the point to me is that eventually, you know, as Labour people, we want to redistribute income and wealth across this country. But we will only do it. We will only do it when we redistribute power across this country. And that's why we need PR, and that's why we need to work on it.
Okay, just very quickly, the first point, I totally agree with you. I think there's huge potential to go into those three areas and try and make some progress. I will just state two facts that are depressing facts, but they are facts. The first is that young people don't currently vote. Only 43% of them did at the last election. That's low. Perhaps Jeremy Corbyn will enthuse them, and hopefully he does, but it is low. And on the other side of the dice is the fact that our support amongst older people, people over 65, dropped hugely from 31 to 23. So we need to sort of remember, yes, go for the hope and go for those three things that you talked about, but we need to not lose people as well. The second chap who raised a point with me about the last election, look, I think what I meant was that the ground game was good. I don't think anybody thinks the air game was brilliant, but the ground game was good. I think the only way that you get people out to vote is knocking on their doors. Perhaps Richard can talk about the fantastic campaign he ran in Ilford North. But the way you improve, the way you increase turnout is by a good ground operation where you knock on doors. And I think my personal view is that the Labour Party did a good job at that, but maybe I'm biased. And finally, I think you're right to mention the elephant in the room. And I, as I said in my previous answer, I think there is a danger that we're talking to ourselves on this issue. Because we get in a room with people who support electoral reform, and we're not rooting it in a wider conversation. So I talked earlier on about how we can make a political case for the Labour Party. I also think we need to be talking about how we can root political reform in the widest sense of frustration out there with politics. You know, Jeremy Corbyn's been elected on a surge of, you know, the new politics. The new politics, the answer to a lot of the new politics, as we've heard today, is people feeling like their vote matters. It's not seeing politicians tearing chunks out of each other in the chamber. And we just need to kind of broaden our conversation about this issue so we can tap into that wider sense of how we can reform our politics and regain trust. I don't think we're doing that adequately at the moment.
Mm. Katie, do you want to perhaps...
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, on so I think, James, you said, you know, people got it right kind of under first past the post. What happens under the current system is that so many people vote tactically. They actually vote for somebody they don't want in order to keep out somebody else. So I don't think we can say there's much... what's are you doing that?
It's a tiny percentage.
It's not a tiny percentage at all. It's not in terms of... when you look at the stats on this, and obviously it's quite a hard thing to measure as well, a lot of people are having to choose between their heart and their head under election time, and that will only increase under the current system. So I think I'd really kind of challenge you on that. There's nothing Alice in Wonderland about the enormous gulf that has opened up between people and formal party politics, and there's nothing Alice in Wonderland about the fact that before the alternative vote referendum, support for UKIP was around 900,000 votes, and now they've had 3.5 million people. Shall I move that just in case? You know, there's nothing Alice in Wonderland about that. The conversation we all have is rooted in reality, which is that people are expressing their preferences in different ways, and they are currently voting for a wider range of parties than they ever have done before. And the question for Labour is how to respond to those facts. I don't think that's Alice in Wonderland at all. Won't repeat the kind of points that Neil's made, but the fact is, under multi-party politics, we are having coalitions are going to be formed. And I was listening to Professor John Curtis the other day saying that it's more likely to be a bit of an anomaly to have had this majority government formed, that the actual long-term trends are towards more hung parliaments. So we've got a choice, haven't we? We can have a coalition that is formed that does not in any way, that the party power in that government, in that administration, doesn't reflect the popular support for those parties in the room and at the table. Or we could look at do a different way of things and say in a multi-party area there is going to be more power sharing in government, but actually that we think the people's will should be fairly reflected in those governing parties, which is what you have under PR systems.
Mm. Great. Richard, do you want to offer some thoughts to those questions? We're coming up to 9 o'clock, so I'll
keep you brief.
Yeah.
I want to start with your bit about saying you're taking all male questions. I think our biggest challenge of those of us who believe in PR is the rooms full of people in favour of PR don't seem to be the people who will disproportionately benefit when we get a PR system. Now, that isn't a problem that you guys turn up, but we've got to do this politics better and bring more people with us. Because it should be a politics that diversifies our parliament, means it looks more like the public, and that does mean more women, but more ethnic minorities, more other groups who aren't traditionally engaged in our politics, and we must bring this to them in that way going forward. I think the equally with that is this idea that PR, because there was a rubbish question put by unpopular people at a particular time, is dead for an election. Labour lost in 2010 and it got up off its feet pretty quickly and wanted to go back within 5 years. That's not an unreasonable thing to do. That's how our electoral system works. We got pummeled again, but we've got to get up off our feet and we've got to go back and do it. Just because you lose a referendum doesn't mean you don't ever ask big questions again. But I think our offer was so small and it looked like it was a panacea to what is a bigger discontentment problem out there. And I think we therefore must go back with answers that are that big. And I agree with David Miliband, who argued before we should have had a referendum on House Lords reform, a form of PR that people could get on board with, and a whole series of democratic reforms, lobbying reform, and a number of things at the same time where people could have seen a step change in politics rather than this idea that was so easily chipped away at that one change would have delivered such disparate outcomes. And my fear always of these things is we ascribe so much to PR that it will be the solution to so many problems, and I fear it's not. I think it's quite small the impact it will gain, but it will change disproportionately a culture that is very hard to write into a leaflet to win the argument for it. The other bit on you asked about the kind of getting non-voters to vote, and this is really important. And there are things that we can do, not least technology can help lots of those things. When we're going knocking on people's doors already, identifying the reason why you're not knocking at somebody's door. Is it because they've said they're voting Tory before and they hate you and they're never going to vote for you? Or is it because they're not on the register and therefore we can do something about that? That could be really important. There is a number of things we could do to make that possible to get out there. But the reason why I come back to being in favour of compulsory voting and what I saw in Australia, and I take all the critiques of it, but America is equally as a polarised system and it doesn't have, you don't have to be on the register, let alone go out to vote. So if the similar outcome with polar opposite systems is, I never had the conversation with my colleagues about reducing other people's likelihood to vote. And I think that was a good thing. I also, in all the meetings, there were people who do find it harder to vote. And even if they had to in Australia, we made a point of talking to those disproportionately to make it easier for them to get there. And poorer people, who disproportionately are the people who do not vote in this country, were just a default part of our conversation. And I think that is a good thing. I agree, don't think it's a panacea. I don't think politicians should be left off the hook. I would put none of the above on the ballot paper, and that might bring us into crisis on a number of occasions. But I think there are positives from it, and we have got to do a thing. And also, I think we've got to go back and also be ready at the next crisis in politics, because there's bound to be one coming, because there are so many problems under our crippling system, with a big offer for people going forward. But I think we have to say, you've got to be part of this as well. You can't opt out. The idea there is virtue in sitting at home and saying they're all the same is, I just think, not true. And the reality is, to our friend who said people think our parties are too close together, nobody didn't vote for Labour because they thought they were too much like the Conservatives in the last election. That wasn't true. Edmund had a pretty distinct offer that he was offering the country, and we were rejected on being different from them, not by being the same as them.
Mm. Well, I don't know about you, but it's 9 p.m. and I'm very excited about electoral reform. It's going to keep me buzzing all the way home on the train to London, thinking about how we can make the case for this. And I'm not saying that sarcastically. I think there's some real passion that's been shown today, and people who genuinely believe fiercely in the need to reform our political system. And, you know, I think the winds are very much moving in that direction. With, you know, for the first time in a long time, that there are a number of very significant political parties that would be receptive and are receptive to the arguments that have been bouncing around these walls, from the Liberal Democrats who feel bruised and hurt by the result, to UKIP who started on the outside, are still on the outside, to the Greens, and to Labour. And I think, you know, you could make a convincing case that the wider climate has never been as favourable for supporters of electoral reform as it is at the moment. So, you know, let's leave on an optimistic, forward-looking message. I'd like to thank you all for coming along. I'd like to thank the speakers for offering their thoughts. And if you have any other questions or comments, I'm sure they'd take those after this evening. So thank you very much.
Thanks ever so much. Sorry if my passion went slightly
low. No worries. No worries. Just wanted to get as many questions as possible.
Yeah, hello. It's going to be a bit of a sort. 10 branch.